From the Moen Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm Stephen Cuevas in for John Horn. On today's show, a new effort to create more diversity in the ranks of TV and movie critics. Then, how a bout with depression inspired artist Connie Gephardt to create one of the most anticipated video games of the year.
Hundreds of fans wrote me. Almost every one of them told me that just alone because I opened up about loneliness, I felt this way. They felt less lonely.
And we'll meet a metal musician who moonlights, or is that daylights, as an elementary school teacher. All that coming up on The Frame.
KPCC podcasts are supported by HBO, presenting Game of Thrones. Critics have hailed the final season as TV's greatest show of all time and era-defining, Emmy-eligible for Outstanding Drama Series and all other categories.
Welcome back to The Frame. I'm Stephen Cuevas in for John Horn. Thanks for joining us. Video games and violence often go hand in hand, but what about video games and psychotherapy? Connie Gephardt is a game designer and co-founder of the Berlin-based production house Yomai. And in her new game, Sea of Solitude, the dungeon master is loneliness. The story is set in a desolate city that's sinking into the ocean. The protagonist is a young woman who's become a monster, and she's searching the city for a cure, for a way to be human again. I met up with Gephardt following her recent unveiling of Sea of Solitude at the E3 convention in Los Angeles. We talked about how the theme and the imagery of the game actually come from her own personal experiences. But we started with her introduction to gaming.
When I was 17, I got offered a comic artist job in Berlin. I'm originally from a small fishing village. My family are fishermen. So I have been drawing. And the friends of my father had been a friend of the owner of this book house, which was very super famous in East Germany, where I'm from.
Did you submit them some art, or was your art seen somewhere?
So we call it Vitamin B, because the friend of my father knew the boss of this comic house had a huge yacht where I'm from in the Baltic Sea.
I see.
So, and my grandparents are fishermen, and they live close by, and so the boats were next to each other. So they knew each other. So my parents said, oh, my daughter can draw very well. Maybe you can have a look at it. And they offered me a job immediately.
And how did the transition from being a visual artist to being a video game designer and artist, how did that transition happen?
So I always loved computer games. So right after the wall fell, my parents bought me a Nintendo console and an Atari. I was 8 or something. So I fell in love with video games. But that wasn't the thing that you could learn in Germany, that you can become a game developer. So I had been a comic artist for a while, and then I got offered an animation job in an animation industry as a storyboard artist in a French animation house. So I did that. And then at some point, a friend of mine said, oh, a game design school opened. The first game design school back in the Games Academy.
In the East or the West?
It was already 2002.
Okay, so it was just Berlin at that point.
Yeah. I was 20, so I applied there because I immediately said, oh my God, now you can become a game developer. So I applied there and I got a scholarship, and now I'm officially a game designer.
Yeah,
so this is how
it
started.
As a child, though, what was it about gaming that drew you in?
I was always interested in stories and always interested in fantastic worlds, different settings. Like in my mind, I always wanted to travel the whole world. I love science fiction also, and really not only consuming, watching like the movies, but really playing it for yourself. And I can just relax and enjoy the environment and figure out what's going on.
It's funny, you mentioned growing up on the Baltic Sea in a small village.
Yeah.
So the sea was always part of your life.
Yes.
And SOS is this submerged world.
Yeah. the setting on Sea of Solitude, the game I develop, is Berlin, my chosen hometown, where I live now for 20 years. It's loosely based on Berlin, but there are actually real settings in there, like train stations that you can recognize if you're in Berlin and if you played the game. But I love my hometown, my real hometown in the Baltic Sea. I grew up next to the beach. Like I said, my family are fishermen, so I had been in boats often. And so it was always like water and big cities what I loved. And also my whole family, I don't know why, loves like sea monsters. We love watching Jaws and stuff. My grandpa, who's still going to fish every day, 4 in the morning, he drives out. He's 85 or something.
He's still
up until his last day, I'm sure. So we always watched like sea monster movies. So the setting, and it was so natural to just use my past and what I love. Sea of Solitude is about this young woman named Kay, who's suffering from such strong loneliness that her inner feeling, the darkness, the anger, the feeling of hopelessness, worthlessness, turns to the outside and she becomes a monster. The game is about finding out why this happened to her, but also how to turn her back into a human.
And what are some of the challenges involved in that journey?
So, like story-wise, the biggest challenge for her is to figure out what issues she actually has. She, at the beginning, has some kind of amnesia. She doesn't even know that she has issues.
Wait, that monster, it seems familiar.
But she sees that something seems to be wrong with her. So step by step, by interacting with other beings in this world that are connected to her closely, she figures out that she actually has issues. And step by step, she figures out, okay, this is why I am right now like I am.
Oh, you're trapped again. Let me help.
We're talking with Connie Geppert. She's the creator of the video game Sea of Solitude. We talked about how the sea and where you grew up was very much influential in the environment for Sea of Solitude.
Yeah.
But why ultimately did you choose to set it in this flooded world?
Yeah.
I would imagine, I guess, knowing the sea so well that you know its power, its danger, as well as its beauty.
Yes, I almost drowned, like I think, 3 times in my life. So I know the danger, but also I love swimming and diving and everything. Sea of Solitude is deeply metaphorical. So the water itself has a deep meaning, the rising, the lowering. And I let it open for the player to interpret why is the water rising at some point and the main character cannot access areas anymore, or why is it lowering in between to the very ocean ground and then she can go there? Why?
And so, I mean, a player could see it on different levels. They could just see it as a fun game, or they can see it on this much deeper level, I suppose.
Yes, yes. So this is my main goal, that in this game, you meet other monsters in between that are much bigger in size. Mm-hmm. And they are in the core also humans that suffer from different types of loneliness. You don't always need to have like mental health issues or something. We all, like humans, you and me, suffer or know the feeling of loneliness. So this I portray too in the game.
Oh, it looks so sad.
What you're trying to address is isolation, loneliness, depression.
Yeah. Yeah.
But gaming can be very isolating, and it can be an escape in a positive way or a negative way.
Yeah.
But SOS is designed in part to help people come out of that.
Yeah.
But so do you worry that that's a very fine line where one could be playing the game, but maybe also still be isolated and not go further in trying to improve themselves or to get help?
So I need to avoid that. It's not that I have the ultimate solution to something. It's a personal story. But last year, when I addressed it at E3 on stage, and millions of people saw it, afterwards, literally hundreds of fans wrote me, and like almost every one of them told me that just alone because I mentioned the theme, that I opened up about loneliness, that I felt this way, they felt less lonely and heard and could relate. And I cried in between when I looked at all the fan mails, that they already felt better just because someone opened up about an issue they have. But with the game, I also try to show how I overcame my issues. And it's not about becoming a total superhero at the end, but to get a little bit more okay with the downsides of life, to be more calm and okay with how you are, with the bad things, the good things. This is what I try to show without spoiling too much.
Mm-hmm. I'm wondering if you consulted with any like mental health experts in the game development?
So I actually went to psychoanalysis for almost 5 years. What is it's really long. In Germany, we have a good health system. They pay for it. Okay, sorry. And with that, I found out about myself also very much. But this man helped me also very much to do it right with Sea of Solitude.
Yeah. So did he offer any insight or advice as it was being developed, as the game was being developed?
No, he was very just listening to what I had to say, and if I did it in the right direction or the right way, he was supporting me. But it, like I said, I'm not a therapist. I just tell a personal story, and he encouraged me when he saw that I went the right direction about and how I wanted to tell certain aspects.
Connie, thank you again so much.
And yeah, thank you for having me.
Coming up on The Frame, a new effort to diversify the ranks of film and TV critics.
KPCC podcasts are supported by HBO, presenting Sharp Objects, based on the best-selling novel by Gillian Flynn. The story focuses on Camille Preaker, a journalist with a history of psychiatric issues who returns to her rural hometown to cover the apparent murders of two preteen girls. The limited series was hailed by critics as exquisite, hauntingly compelling, and a true masterpiece. Emmy eligible for Outstanding Limited Series and all other categories. Visit hbo.com/FYC for more on Sharp Objects.
Welcome to The Frame. I'm Stephen Cuevas in for John Horn. And now, six professional groups that represent film and TV critics and writers announced this week the formation of a coalition to address diversity, inclusion, and access in entertainment journalism. They call themselves the Critics Groups for Equality in Media, or CGEM. It's an alliance of African American, Asian American, Latino, LGBTQ, and women journalists. Time's Up Entertainment joins them as well. John Griffiths is the executive director of the Society of LGBTQ Entertainment Critics and one of the founders of the new coalition. He told me how this effort came together.
We are six groups that have together swapped some notes and some horror stories about how, even in this era of inclusivity and diversity in Hollywood, critics groups, entertainment journalists, mm-hmm. Of diversity and inclusion have been sort of still kept at bay, taken not very seriously, treated with a little condescension.
By whom exactly?
Hollywood about? Studios, certain PR divisions, celebrity public relations houses, and a lot of studios and networks and PR people, they're all about numbers, and they don't yet see the value despite all the headlines. But at least when it comes to entertainment journalists, there's a lot of frustration from underrepresented groups that they feel that they're just not getting the access that they, you know, that they should be.
When it comes to film criticism specifically, which is what you are, what do you think goes missing when we don't have enough gay, lesbian, Black, Latino film critics out there talking about the films and writing about the films that they're seeing?
if it's just a bunch of straight white guys reviewing films and TV shows, there's a certain prism. It's a sort of a myopic vision of what TV and film might be able, the characters and what touches people and what might, the stories that might affect people. But if you just sort of assume that movies and TV shows are just reviewed by these guys, then people read those reviews and that's all they're reading. And there's criticism about this or that, that criticism of how things could be better or what's missing is just seen through that prism, and it's very narrow.
And, you know, can you sort of give us some concrete actions that CGEM hopes to take to create some change here?
We're calling ourselves a watchdog group to some extent. We'd like to champion more diversity and inclusion in media newsrooms, bylines, and also get more access to screenings and screeners from so we could review the content more fully and more engagement from the studios and the networks and gatekeepers, the celebrity publicists, and also better pay for these journalists. And entertainment journalists are coming from a world of passion and obsession almost. And you wouldn't believe how many people just decide to, you know, write something for pennies on what used to be the dollar. The rate for entertainment journalists in general has not gone up. It's gone down since the 1970s.
Yeah. And it's great to have an organization to advocate on behalf of reporters and critics working in the entertainment field. But given the state of journalism that we're kind of living in right now, where are they supposed to work?
Right. And to your point, I mean, that's because the landscape is changing so much.
Yeah.
I think the networks and studios and PR companies are going to have to look at things differently. That we have, there are some very well-regarded and maybe even influential websites that they might not have ever heard of, that have a lot of followers and people that really get people to movies or don't, you know, depending on what the take is.
What's the first thing, the first priority, the first goal that CGEM wants to accomplish?
Our two initiatives, and we're going to do this with a lot of thought. It's not going to be knee-jerk. We want to award, perhaps, the publicists or industry champions that really get where we're coming from and engage with us nicely and have a history of that. And then also create a sort of grading system for the different studios and networks and celebrity PR houses. Just because some of the treatment has just been really great. It's so heartening from allies, quote unquote. And it's not like we're just dying to get to dole out Fs and stuff like that. And we don't want to hurt anybody's business, but we do want to raise awareness and have more than a conversation, quote unquote. We'd like some solutions and some action.
John Griffiths is executive director of Gallica, the Society of LGBTQ Entertainment Critics, and a founder of the New Alliance Critics Groups for Equality in Media. John, thank you.
It's been a pleasure. I'm so grateful. Thanks to you.
Coming up on The Frame, a real-life musician and teacher living out his own school of rock. Welcome back to The Frame. I'm Stephen Cuevas sitting in for John Horn. Bay Area musician Steve Von Till lives an unusual dual life as an artist. He's a longtime member of the post-metal band Neurosis and an elementary school teacher up in northern Idaho. I recently visited his classroom, and he told me the band probably wouldn't have survived if members hadn't taken day jobs. And his students, they seem pretty happy that he chose teaching.
Mr. Von Till's nice. He lets me do my work on my own time. And he has mystical creatures. Dun, dun, dun.
He actually has pine cones as our hall passes, which is actually amazing.
He makes learning lots of fun. Every day I go to school, it makes me happy to think about the day that we might have.
I'm definitely aware that I don't look like your stereotypical elementary school teacher. I'm heavily tattooed. I have a long beard. I'm bald. I definitely have a preference for black jeans and t-shirts. But kids don't care about that at all. They just see you for who you are. They do not have the ego traps that adults have. My name is Steve Von Till. I am a guitarist and singer in the group Neurosis. And I am also an elementary school teacher and have been for the last almost 19 years. I joined Neurosis in 1989, about 4 years into their existence. And at the time, we were all part of this Bay Area DIY punk rock movement when they needed to replace their second guitarist. I was lucky enough to get that spot. A bigger heavy metal band, probably one of the biggest at that time, Pantera, took us out later on in the 90s, as well as we were on an Ozfest an entire month playing with Black Sabbath and Ozzy. Doing 2 20-minute sets a day to completely unsuspecting mainstream audiences with our feral, intense, what they must have thought is noise. While musically and artistically we felt we were peaking and still had more peaks to reach, lifestyle-wise, we'd seen the same gas station truck stop mart in Indiana 4 or 5 times in the same year. We weren't at home being good fathers, being good husbands. We were, you know, actually digging debt. In the best case, we probably would have made artistic compromises that I can't imagine living with. In the worst case, we would have imploded. It would be better if we walk the other direction a few steps and find balance between work, family, and art. I had to contemplate, what was my job going to be? What was I going to do to pay the bills for the family if we weren't on tour all the time? The school district where I went to elementary school was desperate for teachers, and that if you had any 4-year college degree, you could get in a classroom and take your education classes at night. So almost before I had had a chance to make it a preconceived idea, I was in a classroom.
Good morning.
I teach 4th grade. Kids are 9 turning 10 throughout the year. It's a great privilege to be at the school that I'm at, because we've always been thought of as very warm and a loving environment for families and students.
Everybody, let's sit quietly and relax and practice a little mindfulness on this Monday.
I've got no need to promote my music to 9-year-olds. And I just play it low-key. It's just part of what I do.
And as you're breathing in, feel your lungs expand.
When I am lucky enough to be able to travel, I can come back and share stories with my students of, hey, I just got back from Japan. I can share my own stories that I've visited these places and hopefully inspire a curiosity about the wider world. As an educator, we always hope that we will inspire the desire to be a lifelong learner.
And as you press the key up towards yourself,
in a science lesson, for example, if we're talking about waves and sound waves, you know, then I can bring in interesting instruments from home and we can talk about how they might generate their sound, how it all works. That'll go off onto a tangent where we might get on the internet and take a virtual field trip to Tuva and listen to some throat singing. Or go to Japan and listen to some taiko drumming. Something, again, that just broadens the experience and the curiosity in the world based on something as simple as sound waves.
Stand by, and we're rolling.
Shenandoah, I long to hear you.
Almost every day, my students and I will take 10 minutes and sing some folk songs. And I think the heritage of American folk music is an interesting part of our culture to pass on as well, even if it's just through a little exposure.
Across the wide Missouri.
And when we sing, it's really fun for some of the people who either want to pursue singing into a career or just like singing.
I think it's like pretty crazy because he's a rock star and he's a teacher.
I'm bound away across the wide Missouri.
I think it sets an interesting example for students that they see professional musicians and artists are also working people that don't necessarily earn a living from their art, that they need to carry on with, quote, regular jobs to support their families, that not everybody is a celebrity or a rock star. So I think it's important for them to see that you can follow your dreams, follow your passion, even if it doesn't necessarily pay the way. You do it because you're driven to do it. And children have a lot to do with me keeping this perspective, is to never losing my sense of wonder and to never lose my sense of curiosity as a musician and as a teacher.
Steve Von Till in the fourth grade class from Garwood Elementary School near Coeur d'Alene, Idaho. Steve will be at his other job most of the summer, on tour with the band Neurosis. And that's all for The Frame for this week. Hope you like our new opening theme music. It's by Taylor McFerrin. Look for his albums on your favorite streaming service. I'm Stephen Cuevas. Thanks for listening. John Horn is back here on Monday at the Moen Broadcast Center. Have a great weekend.